Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. You know, I'd love to think that we're entering a golden age of Indian food culture in America. It's overdue, especially since, you know, it's one of the world's greatest and most influential cuisines, but I am totally here for it. And I think this because for the first time ever last year, a James Beard Award went to a chef, Chintan Pandya, who serves what he calls unapologetic Indian food. Some of our absolute best writers and editors on any food subject, including Indian food, are Indian Americans. Now I'm thinking of stars like Priya Krishna, Tejal Rao, Khushbu Shah, Nick Sharma, Sonia Chopra, many others. And of course, the face of Top Chef is Padma Lakshmi, who talks with as much passion about the food she grew up with as what she eats on TV. But of course, it wasn't always this way. Indian immigrants to America make up less than 1% of the population. And they only started arriving in earnest in the mid-60s. Back then, it was only about 12,000 people a year. And they didn't often get into food service. Actually, most Indian restaurants in New York are actually run by Bangladeshis, which is a fascinating story for another time. But my point is, Indian food's growth in America has really happened, you know, within my lifetime, certainly within the last couple of decades. And one of the heroes who helped get us here is a former chemist in Minnesota named Raghavan Iyer. The author of many books on Indian food, including the legendary, massive, fan-favorite 660 Curries, Raghavan was once named Cooking Teacher of the Year by the International Association of Culinary Professionals. He turned Betty Crocker, of all companies, onto Indian food, and he has been a dear friend to our show for decades. He has a new cookbook. It's called On the Curry Trail. It's about how Indian food, and the idea of curry specifically, has traveled around the globe to make some of the most beloved dishes on earth. And he joins us today to talk about that and about how he became the icon that he is. So, hey, Raghavan, so good to see you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be seen, actually, in those both ways.
Okay, but let's start, because you have spent your whole, you know, award-winning career teaching Americans about Indian food. But your new book, it's called On the Curry Trail. It's sort of funny because in some ways it's barely about the food of India. What I mean is it's about Indian Chinese food and Indian Portuguese food and Indian Jamaican food. It's about how Indian people and flavors and culinary ideas have traveled around the world. So what inspired you to write a book on this subject?
My editor and I were plotting, and, you know, she said that your 660 Curry book is like a cult classic. She says, why don't we think about doing something along the lines? And I thought, well, I've always wanted to do sort of a follow-up to the 660 Curries. And so I thought, you know, a book about curries around the world, not to be as big as 660. And I thought, you know, maybe keep it shorter and do 50 curries from around the world. But I wanted to focus it and look at the diaspora of curries and curry powders, because that's really what the book showcases through the eyes of the colonials. I mean, Lord knows we were pummeled by colonials for hundreds and hundreds of years. And, you know, everybody from the Portuguese to the Spanish to the Danish and the French. And then, of course, the queen of it all, you know, the British came and settled. And the British were there for about at least 300 or 400 years, if I'm not mistaken. And they left an impact on the curry scene. I mean, you know, some people say, well, gee, they made curry hip. I said, well, curry's been hip in India for 6,000 years. but I said what they did was they introduced curries in the form of curry powders. They loved the sauciness of some of the curries they sampled along the southeast and the northwest. And then they had their cooks put together a cornucopia of spices that they ground up and put them into a jar and labeled it as curry powder. Because when they went back to England, you know, they wanted to try and replicate the flavors of curries in India, and so they came up with the concept. But it was, interestingly enough, not until the Indians, you know, went to wherever the Brits wanted them to go, in the form of slaves first and then indentured servants, that the Indians actually helped spread the concept of curry powders to the rest of the world. And so when you look at curries in China or curries in the Caribbean islands, or, you know, anywhere in Europe for that matter, and of course the Middle East and Africa, curry powders were synonymous with it. The book 660 Curries, you know, delves into the world of sauces, because to us Indians, you know, curries have everything to do with sauces and nothing really to do with spices. And and so when we, you know, wanted to sort of spread the gospel of curries according to the English, we did it based on what they had come up with, which was curry powders.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So, you know, so to us, when we say curries, we always associate the word sauce or a gravy to it. Mm-hmm. So in situations like that, I've always said curry is never added. It just is. Curry is not a flavor. It's an entity. Mm-hmm. And with this book, it's completely the opposite. So that's what the book really focused on. And so lots of research, lots of storytelling, which I think is what makes the book one of those books that you can take to bed and read.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's so many like tidbits of history and also like your personal observations. It's super interesting to get into your mind about this. And, you know, as someone who has written, you know, as someone who's written this incredibly massive deep dive into really into Indian cuisine, and really the message of that book is curries are about sauces and sort of saucy dishes, not about a flavor profile or a mix of spices. But then that word being more of a British word than really like a Hindi word, or you know, I believe actually curry comes from like a Tamil word, but
yes, it does. Yeah,
being more of a British word, you know, and when they spread this idea of curries around, like you said, it was more in their mind about the flavor of the mix of spices. And you know, when I was growing up in a Chinese family, we had dishes that we called curries that were made with spices that were often, you know, turmeric based, you know, basically using curry powder that, you know, I loved.
Madras curry powder,
Yeah, I loved like Hong Kong chicken curry that we would have that was savory and a little bit sweet, and like coconut milk, and Malaysian curries and Thai curries are kind of a different thing entirely.
They are, yep. They're a class of its own.
Yeah, but then like there wasn't that much like dried spices used as a seasoning in other, in many Chinese dishes I knew of, for instance. But we would see things like what we called Singapore rice noodles, which were rice noodles that were stir-fried, but with curry powder as the seasoning. In your book, you have a recipe for curry fried rice, which is, you know, a Chinese dish made with a British curry powder. When you first encountered that, what did you think?
I, you know, I loved it because I just felt like at least I could, you know, sample some spices in the in my rice, and it's not just plain, you know, boring white rice. And I really enjoyed
nothing boring about white rice. Come on.
No, I love white rice. Trust me. I mean, if I don't have rice for 2 days, you know, my body goes into some kind of a shock. And I love white rice, you know. And I've never been a big fan of brown rice or anything, because to me, you know, when you eat brown rice, I mean, it's so textural. And if you don't have enough seasonings in it, you know, there's nothing that comes off it. You know, it's like a cow chewing, and the more you chew, the more saliva you create, and you dilute the flavors, you know. And so so I think when you're working with something that's textural, people forget to up the ante on the flavors.
That's interesting.
I was fortunate to learning Chinese cooking from, you know, a grand dame of Chinese foods. She wrote the Time Life series for Chinese cooking. Her name was Florence Lin. And Florence was a master teacher, you know, and she had come years ago to Minneapolis, and we had brought in two master chefs from the northern part of China, you know, where they specialized in noodles and dumplings. And she had written a book about noodles and dumplings. And so I had actually done a dish of hers with curry powder. And she used, in her original recipe, she used Madras curry powder. So the smartass that I was, I thought, well, you know, being from India, I'm going to, you know, not use a store-purchased curry powder, but I'm going to make my own blend. Uh-huh. And so I did. And she said, very good class, she said, but not good because you used your own curry powder. You have to use Madras curry powder. So she was very, very specific on the kind of curry powders that you end up using. And I, you know, just from that short amount of feedback, I just thought, wow, I mean, you talk about, you know, a master teaching the art. And she was very good at it. And I learned so much from her those couple of weeks that she was there, you know. And and these noodle makers, I mean, you know, they made the noodles by hand, you know, where they pull the noodles and, you know, the finer the strand, the more elaborate their techniques, you know. And I was just so mesmerized by that.
Yeah.
And the flavors were just so, I mean, you could just eat the noodles as is, you know, because they were so good. She left an indelible mark on, you know, to me, what signified curry powders from the Chinese standpoint. Mm-hmm, And I just thought it was a wonderful mélange of flavors. And so so the curry puffs are an adaptation of her recipe in the book, and the curried fried rice is an homage to her technique.
Yeah. And again, it's interesting that, like, you know, this incredibly deep culinary culture of India and of South Asia generally, right, that, you know, has these dishes called curries, and somehow, you know, that gets, that word, that idea gets sort of like embodied in this very specific powdered spice mix that, you know, has so little to do with where it comes from. But then that spice mix becomes the iconic flavor that even a master chef like Florence Lin is going to be like, no, you got to use that stuff. What are you doing grinding spices?
Yeah. Because that's what was introduced to her by the English, you know. And I mean, even in England, people say, oh, let's go for curry. They don't mean anything specific. It's just anything that has to do with Indian food, you know. And so to them, it was really eating something that's well spiced. And so, of course, you know, the hotter the better for them, you know. And interestingly, you know, the term vindaloo for them signified heat, but to Indians, vindaloo, you know, comes from the Portuguese words vindalios, which is vinegar and garlic. And that's, you know, those are the two key
those are the flavors.
Those are the key flavors in the dish. So from Goa, you know, which had the Portuguese influence.
We'll be back with more with Raghavan Iyer, author of On the Curry Trail. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending time today with the wonderful Raghavan Iyer, legendary cooking teacher and ambassador for Indian food, and author of the new cookbook, On the Curry Trail. Let's get back to it with him. Okay, so you grew up in India, and you've lived in Minnesota for 40 years.
40 years, yep.
So let's actually go back, though, to when you were growing up. You grew up in Mumbai, which was then called Bombay. What were some of your memories from that time? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind really is, you know, my grandmother used to hand feed us as babies. You know, the first thing she would give us, which usually is towards the end of a meal, but that because our stomachs were still, you know, getting adjusted to spices and heat, she used to feed us yogurt rice, you know, plain rice that she would mix with yogurt, and she would flavor that with popped mustard seeds and fresh curry leaves, and that's what she would feed us. And so that would be my first memory. And then we grew up on steamed rice lentil cakes, which we call idlis. And from the same batter, we would make thin crepes out of it, which we call dulces.
Oh, God,
so
I love
to
them.
Me, those, I know, and they still, to me, epitomize, you know, flavors that I grew up with, because, you know, I grew up in a South Indian home kitchen, and that's what we ate. And to this day, interestingly, you know, when I go to India and when I land, it's usually the middle of the night. And the first thing that my sister-in-law makes for me is a stack of dosas. And, you know, so it's like, welcome home.
Does she make them crispy?
We, in home kitchens, we actually make it on the softer side.
Okay.
Not as crispy as you would find in restaurants. There's a little bit of crispness, but definitely, you know, it was on the softer side.
And do you fill them?
You know, we don't make the filling as often. In fact, what we normally eat with it is either a chutney or there's a dry chutney, which we call molaha pudi, which literally means pepper powder. So it's a host of red chilies and sesame seeds and other spices that are toasted and ground. And then we put unrefined sesame oil in it, and we turn it into a slurry.
Oh,
and,
cool.
Yeah, and that's what we dip our dosas in. And so, of course, I'm talking to you without having had lunch, and which is my biggest problem.
you should have prepared.
I should have prepared.
I had a big salad, so I'm not sure that I fully prepared either.
But, you know, I figured, well, maybe sometimes when you're hungry and you're hankering for something, you're better able to talk about it. So, it is. Now, you said, I mean, you know, you also grew up with eating curries.
Mm-hmm.
So when you cook curries to this day, I mean, do you still reach for that can of curry powders?
I don't, although you'd probably be appalled by what I would make and call curry. First of all, you know, just in the comfort of home, right? Like, I would never show what I'm cooking to the world and be like, look, I'm making a curry. But I don't reach for curry powder, like the stuff that you call curry powder so much. I often will use, I'll admit this now, I often will use different masalas that are already pre-mixed and ground, and I'll toast them with aromatics and add the liquid, or you know, add the water or whatever. So functionally, I am using a curry powder, but I'm not using the box of curry powder. I don't often go and toast the whole spices and grind them before dinner.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
And because of that, you know, you reached a higher level for me. You know, and it's like, okay, Francis, you know, I'm glad that you are reaching for something. I mean, it's not uncommon for Indians to use pre-done mixes as well, you know, for a matter of convenience. And even though we're using mixes, sometimes we'll make our own mixes and we'll bottle them, which we'll keep for about 6 to 8 months, and we end up using that. Mm-hmm. And in particular in the South, we use a blend of spices we call sambar masala. Sambar is a stew that is done 365 days a year in South Indian home kitchens. And so we end up using that blend to, you know, also as stir fries or to, you know, prick anything else up. And I mean, our fried rice, for instance, will contain sambar masala, you know, and
that sounds good.
With peanuts and stuff. And so it is, I guess, every country has their own combination of spice blends.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to Mumbai with you. In one of your books, I believe your second book, The Turmeric Trail, you start it with a description of you, I think you being a kid and running around and going to eat the street food with your pocket money. And I think you had this great story of you actually loved getting in trouble at school because that meant you had to stay for detention. And then after detention, you would go out to your favorite vendors. And
yes.
What are some of the things that you would eat?
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't open shop until later, you know, and so my school left at 1:30, and so if I figured if I have a couple of hours of detention, you know, then by the time I get out, you know, one of my favorite vendors was a guy who used to make chana bhatura, which is a stewed garbanzo beans with fried bread, which I loved, and then I would have about, you know, 25, a quarter of a rupee left over, which I would save for going to the old lady who would sell guavas. I love fresh guavas. And, you know, these were ripe and, you know, she would cut them and, you know, into fours and then you would sprinkle them with cayenne pepper and salt. And that's what I would have as a dessert, you know. And so, and I went to school downtown and we lived in the suburbs. And so by the time I got home, you know, my mom would always say, "Don't you want a snack?" I said, "No," because, you know, I was already full. And then we typically don't eat in India until about 8 or 9 o'clock. And I think a lot of countries outside the U.S. eat late dinners. You know, I mean, we don't eat dinners at 4 o'clock. And so I remember when my sister got here first, or even when I got here first to this country, I was appalled. It's like, why would you eat at 5 o'clock? I mean, this is tea time normally, you know, and you would have a snack at this time. And, you know, but my partner, Terry, grew up in a household which ate at 4 o'clock. And, and so, yeah, that was a learning experience. And, you know, now I guess if you think about it, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you do eat earlier because, you know, then you're not, you know, late at night. You know, your stomach is doing all this work where it shouldn't be. It should be resting. And so it makes sense as to why you would eat earlier so that, you know, you're not working your stomach.
Well, actually, since we're talking about you being appalled at first at what time Americans ate. So you moved to the U.S. For your education. What was your impression of the country when you arrived and of the food?
Oh, I mean, you know, the country was like, oh, wow, this is huge, you know, and everything was larger than life, and even your small portions were huge, you know. And but what really appalled me was the lack of, in my mind, the lack of flavors, you know. And I thought, oh my God, I mean, can't you just put any kind of spice in something? Yeah. I mean,
wait, where were you?
Everything. I was in a very small town, southwest Minnesota. It was called Marshall. It was a school of 1,200 kids, you know, and that's where I met Terry. And then 2 years later, we transferred to Michigan State University, and that's where we graduated from. So, you know, we both got a degree in hotel restaurant management. And by then, you know, I was starting to cook, and so I was obviously relying on the world of spices and so on. And so that really helped. I mean, I remember the first time I cooked when I was in Marshall. I mean, I had tears in my eyes because I just thought, oh, my God, your food is awful. I just didn't know how to work and deal with spices. You know, I just thought there is a technique, which I don't know.
Well, how did you learn to cook and how did you get into it?
I learned actually remotely from my mother and sister. You know, this is before you were born, Francis. I would, you know, this age-old, ancient form of letter writing, which I would write these letters and mail them, and, you know, because they were international, overseas letters, it would take a month for them to get it. And it would take a month for them to get back to me, you know, and I would often ask, you know, what goes into a particular dish, or how do you make this? They didn't have recipes per se.
Sure.
You know, and they would give me a rough idea how to make it. But in terms of quantities and measurements, I had to figure that out. And that's why I always said maybe this is where my chemistry degree came into play. My first degree was in chemistry from Bama University.
Okay.
And my second degree was in hotel restaurant management from Michigan State. So I felt like, you know, the science background really grounded me in figuring out, you know, the proportions and the quantities and so on. And so there was, you know, I realized there's a method to the madness of adding how much, you know, and you just don't throw in willy-nilly, you know, spices just for the heck of it. Some spices are designed to go with some and some are not. You know, you also look at how these spices traveled, right? I mean, whoever controlled the Silk Route controlled the spice trade. You know, it was the Middle Easterners who did it. And then, you know, the Venetians had a big control over it. And I remember having a long conversation with our dear mutual friend, Lynn Rizzotto Casper. And, you know, she was talking about the Venetian spices and, you know, how they tended to use spices. And so I talk about the Venetian cupboard, and I created a recipe using bucatini, you know, which is their hollow pasta as long as a spaghetti strand. And I made a sauce with it with, I believe, anchovies. And, you know, you've got this particular combination of spices that went to flavor that. And that was really how, you know, they cooked, because, you know, you looked at spices and it's like, yeah, I'm rich, so I can afford spices. Yeah. As opposed to a poor culture, you know, it's like, well, my food is starting to turn, so I better mask it with spices, you know, and or, you know, use it from a medicinal standpoint, you know. And so the usages were different. And it signified different things, you know. In European cultures, it had to do with wealth. And in non-European cultures, it wasn't. And it was really the poor man's way of making something flavorful. And, you know, you look at the Caribbean islands, for instance, Trinidad and Tobago, where curry powders were introduced by the British, because they brought in slaves from China and India, and, you know, to work the sugarcane fields. Yeah. And they ended up, you know, incorporating those particular flavors, you know, to this day, you know. And what to me is different about the cooking of Trinidad and Tobago, they went after heat. You know, ghost chilies were a prominent player in some of their curries. And, you know, the hotter it was, the better it was. And so, as you've noted in my language, and I tend to differentiate between hot and spicy. I think in a culture, even culinary writers, I think, make a mistake of saying, oh, it's really spicy, where they really mean hot.
They mean chili
hot.
Hot.
Yeah, and so it's like, specify chili hot. You know, don't say spicy equals hot, you know, because to me, you know, 99% of the spices we use are for flavors. So it was really, you know, a pleasure writing the book because of the research that was involved with it.
Well, how did you get into that? How did you get into researching and teaching and writing about Indian food?
I used to work in restaurants in a previous life, and I hated it, you know, and then I worked for a boss. And I worked for a boss who was meaner than can be, and I just couldn't stand him, you know. But I did it because I needed my green card. You know, it took forever, and I got it 18 years later. So as soon as I got out of it, I, you know, years ago when I was in India, I used to teach French, actually. I did a lot of private tutoring. And so I thought, boy, wouldn't it be nice to go back to teaching cooking? Because nobody was doing it at that time. And so I started, and I started teaching Indian cooking because nobody was doing it at that time. And then the teaching led to the writing, and the writing led to the books. Mm-hmm. I remember the first proposal I wrote was actually for the Turmeric Trail, which became my second book, because I ran into, you know, General Mills was in town, and I was at a conference, and I ran into some of the editors at Betty Crocker Kitchens. And I ran into one of them, who was a friend, and I said, hey, I said, is Betty ready for Indian? And she goes, well, I don't know. She goes, why don't you send us a proposal and see what you know, what we think of it? And the publishers were in town, and they had asked me to come and do a lunch for them. And so I made this lunch, which was foods that you know, you would only find in home kitchens in India, and they were multi-regional.
And do you remember what you made?
Yeah, I remember the main course was actually a fresh tuna from Eastern India, which was punctuated with fennel and cumin and black peppercorns and cardamom and bay leaves and cloves. And I served it as is with, you know, some of the dishes from other parts of the country and with a spinach stew from Southern India, which was flavored with fresh coconut and red chilies. And it was, you know, something different. And I thought, oh, man, what do you feed a bunch of jaded New Yorkers, you know? And I thought, it better be something different. And they were totally blown away. And I did a little presentation about it. And so they had the proposal by then. And so apparently when I left the room, they turned to the editors and said, let's sign him up. And that's, you know, they gave me 5 months to write the book, which is 180 recipes. The book came out in 2001.
Brutal.
I know. It was like hardly any time. And, you know, wrote it and got everything tested. And it was, you know, it was a great book in many ways. And to this day, the book is actually in print, even after 21 years.
And incredible that it's Betty Crocker. Like this.
Yep, Betty.
Like this totally Norman Rockwell Americana company. Mm-hmm. And you convinced them to do this super legit regional home style Indian cookbook.
Mm-hmm. And I've always said, you know, don't underestimate an Indian. Because, you know, we'll try to sell you anything we can. Yeah. And, it blew my mind that they did it, and it blew my mind that we commissioned, who's become a dear friend, a well-known national potter by the name of Richard Bresnahan, and we commissioned a lot of his pieces to photograph the food. And so when you look at the book, it has a lot of his artwork, and the food is, you know, and I didn't do anything different about the food, you know, we just made the food, and we put it on these platters and bowls, and the food looked absolutely amazing. And to me, it was really, it showcased the beauty of the platters and the bowls, but it also showcased the beauty of Indian cooking. I've always said the hallmark of a good cuisine, which I, when I talk about Indian food, I mean that, is showcasing 7 taste elements in your complete meal: hot, sour, sweet, salty, bitter, astringent, umami. But you also showcase the colors. You showcase the texture. You showcase the temperature. And you put them all together. A well-executed meal has to balance all of that. It all comes down to the word balance. You know, everything has to sort of work out. And, you know, nothing is off kilter. And it's a culture that is extremely about balance. And they balance life, they balance death, they balance everything so beautifully well that I just feel like, you know, if you want to learn about a sense of balance, then look no further than India.
Coming up, more with Raghavan Iyer. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending our whole episode today with our dear friend, Raghavan Iyer, who spent a decades-long career teaching the world about the beauty and depth of Indian food. Let's get back to it with him. So your second book is The Turmeric Trail, and the book begins, I think even before you get to the first chapter, it's like an introduction to the book. You... there's a lot of personal story, a lot of like memoristic elements in this book. And it's a wonderful book. It was a James Beard Award finalist. But you start the book with this story. It's very loving, but it's also very raw about...
Of my grandmother.
Your grandmother. And
yes.
And how hard her life was and really how much abuse she survived.
Yes, at a young age. You know, I mean, she was married off at 8 years old. And, you know, when she got her first period, which was at 10 years old, that's when she was shipped off to her husband's house because she was ready to have babies, you know. And and that's when my father was born at a young age. And she had four children, two died, and she had two alive. And, yeah, I mean, she just, you know, was horribly abused. And, I mean, you know, and my grandfather was very rich. And he was the only, the lawyer's, he was the lawyer's assistant, basically, and to the only lawyer in town. And he, you know, had a lot of money at his disposal. And, you know, his wife, my grandmother, made all these, you know, expansive foods, but she was denied, you know, food. And she would be given literally morsels of grains of rice in this wicker winnowing kind of a basket thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she had to learn to eat in between so that the rice wouldn't fall out. And that's how she would, you know, have to sustain herself. And coffee, you know, which is so quintessential Southern Indian, she would pluck them and roast them for him and her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law was also a nasty piece of work. And she, and when they were not looking, she would have to steal seeds of coriander, you know, which you use in savory cooking. She would roast them and then she would grind them and she would, you know, brew it, coriander seeds, basically, for giving her that coffee-like comfort.
Mm.
And that's what she drank. You know, that was her cup of coffee. And she would tell us these stories, and we were just appalled, you know. And my, you know, to make that long story short, my grandfather came to visit us. And my grandmother left him in the middle of the night. And when my father came to Mumbai, and he was with the Indian Navy, and, you know, he got settled, and he called my grandmother, and she left him, her husband, in the middle of the night, and she never went back. And he came to see his family and grandchildren in early 61. And my grandmother had nothing to do with them. You know, she didn't give him the time of the day. And so he went back, and, you know, he died soon after. And then I was born right after he died. I was born in April of 61, and I was considered to be his reincarnation. Mm. But it was not in an ugly sort of way. My grandmother always said, you know, poor thing, she says, you were born into this world to pay for your grandfather's sins. Mm. And I could do no wrong in her eyes. And, you know, she would, you know, dote on me, and, you know, I always got special treatment. And not once in her life she ever lifted her hand and slapped us, you know, because that level of abuse that she endured, mm-hmm. she didn't want any of that being passed on to her grandchildren. And my father was the same way, the kindest man. In fact, you know, his oldest was my sister, and she's 22 years older than I am. And she had expressed an interest in going to medical school. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, you're talking in the 50s and unheard of, you know. And he said, you know, he goes, if none of my other children want a medical school, she wants to go. I'm going to do what I can. Mm. He used to pawn my mother's jewelry and put her through medical school. And in fact, she was doing her residency in OBGYN, and she delivered me when I was born.
That's amazing.
And that was... Yeah, and we have a very special relationship. You know, she's 83 now, you know, and she's still fiercely independent. She never married in life, you know, and so she always said, you know, she doesn't need a man to function or survive, and she did just fine. In fact, she was engaged to somebody, and he was asking for a dowry. And she said, you're nuts. She said, I make more money. She said, I make more money than you do. And she said, of course, I'm not going to marry you. And she says, here's your wedding ring back. You need it more than I do. And we broke off the engagement. And she never looked back. And I asked her years later, I said, do you regret it? She goes, not one bit. She goes, who do you think raised you all? And she was right. You know, she raised us, and, you know, she put us through school and through college, and she helped me come to the U.S., you know.
Yeah.
She was very instrumental in that. And so so I think that's one of the reasons why we're very close in terms of our relationships.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I was going to ask you, actually, you know, you start this book by writing this story of your grandmother, and, you know, it's, I was wondering if you were at all, had thought about or maybe was concerned of, hey, if I depict this story, you know, would I be giving people cause to think poorly of Indian culture? Like, how could this happen? But then you tell this story, mm-hmm. that, you know, also shows bravery, decency, goodness, kindness. Mm-hmm.
It shows that no matter where you are, your sacrifices and your love for your children are the same. Years ago, in fact, you know, when Lynn was doing the Splendid Table, and Sally remembers this, she had me read a story from the Turmeric Trail, which was a story associated with steamed milk with almonds and pistachios. When my father, when my sister used to study for her exams, you know, by the light of the moon, my father would go down to the vendor. And, you know, we lived in a 300-square-foot chawl, which was, you know, we had about 14 people living there. And all just all crammed. And, you know, he would go downstairs in his slippers and take a glass with him. And this vendor would be making steamed milk, you know, just as they would, you know, make a frappe, you know, and pour it from one glass to the other to create the froth. Mm. And he would add a little bit of pistachio and almonds and sugar and saffron. And, you know, that would be still warm, and he would carry it over, and, you know, that would be her treat. And, you know, I'll never forget that story, because to me, it epitomized the love that a father had for his daughter. Yeah. Especially during a time when, you know, people always said, oh, why bother spending so much money or time or energy on a daughter, because she's going to get married and go away, which is not the case, you know, everywhere. And so he really, really set an example of how to treat women. And interestingly enough, you know, all my siblings, when they got married and they had children, they all fervently hoped for girls, for children, you know, because of the influence that my father had and my grandmother had, you know, and which was, I think, very telling how important it was to nurture that that relationship.
That's lovely. And I know you're looking forward to going to go see your sister.
Yes. You know, unfortunately, I came down with COVID yesterday. And so after my quarantine, I'm still hoping to go. In my list, the only things I want to do is eat and drink. And I've got my list of my foods and my street vendors that are safe to go to. And, you know, the fresh fruit juices that I can drink, you know, and, you know, especially I look at fresh sugarcane juice, which is the sweetness is cut down with ginger and lime, and it is just heavenly, you know. And so, so things of that nature is, I think, as you know, food is what is the common binder. And as we all know, food is used so powerfully, positively and negatively, you know. Yeah. And to this day, I mean, you see both sides of it. And I cannot imagine, you know, I mean, food being such a big part of who I am. I mean, I remember even when you know, my son was young, you know, and he would throw a tantrum about something. And, you know, my partner would say, then go to bed hungry. And I would just be appalled. And I would tell Terry, I said, no. You said, you know, you can't let him go hungry. Terry's like, well, he's not going to die if he doesn't eat one meal. I said, that's not the point. I said, you know, you have to feed your child. And, you know, and I would go against Terry, and I would make sure that my son would eat something before he goes to bed. And so he realizes the importance of food and what it really, really means. And you know, and I just feel like it is one of those things that hopefully he carries on and passes it on to his own children.
Yeah,
so
for sure. When we talked the other day, you also said that you felt your relationship to food change. On some level, while writing your latest book, you were so gratified to be in the recipe testing and the research and giving you purpose. But also now feeling like, oh, your body uses food in a different way, or you're approaching food in a different way.
Yes, and in fact, just, you know, it's like when we're young, we use food to nurture and to grow. As we get older, we use food because we enjoy it. And as we get older and we get old, we are back to our childhood phase where we use food for restorative purposes. And, you know, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer about almost 5 years ago, and that dramatically changed my relationship with food. You know, I remember after my first surgery, I lost 30 pounds, which to me is appalling because the maximum I've ever weighed was 155. And I was like 125, you know, just gaunt and horrible. And the only thing that helped me put on weight was these hankering for this dish that I mentioned early on, idlis, you know, these steamed rice lentil cakes, which I would eat with some yogurt. And that helped me put on weight. Nothing like illness to, you know, bring you close to your comfort food you have. That's what you're going to go after.
Yeah. It has been such a joy to get to talk with you, Raghavan.
Oh, likewise, you know, and I've been a big fan of you and your work as not only as a host, but as an editor and as a writer. And I've always enjoyed what you do and, you know, to come and be on your show. Has really been quite a deep pleasure of mine. So I look forward to continued conversations, and hopefully when you're in town, you know, we could share a meal together with our dear friend Lynn.
I'd love that.
I look forward to that as well.
Well, thank you. Enjoy your trip to India.
Thank you.
And I hope you get all the idlis you could ever want.
Yes, and I will have an idli for you as well. And thank you so much, Francis. And I look forward to sharing a table and more stories with you in the near future.
Raghavan Iyer's latest book is On the Curry Trail. He left us with a recipe for prawn curry with darkened cinnamon. It sounds totally incredible. You can find it at splendidtable.org. I hope you enjoyed spending time with him as much as we have. Like I said, Raghavan has been a dear, dear friend of our show for many years. He and Lynn still have dinner all the time. She says hi, by the way. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for tuning in. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavani, Alex Schaffert, and Jomaine Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.